On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We've got a very special guest for President's Day, Paul Carter, the author of Richard Nixon, California's Native Son. It's from Potomac Books. You can check their website, nebraskapress.unl.edu/Potomac, for more information. And the difference between this book and probably every other book you've read about Richard Nixon is that it has a lot of really wonderful stories and a really well-rounded look at the first native Californian to be elected to the presidency and the incredible political career he had long before Watergate and what happened to him afterwards. It's a great story and it's worth telling. Paul Carter is an attorney with more than 20 years of experience in investigation and trial work. The author of the biographical map, Native Son, Richard Nixon, Southern California, and his website is richardnixonsocal, that's like Southern California, .com. The foreword was by Tricia Nixon Cox. And I'm so excited that we're going to get a chance to talk to Paul Carter about his book. Welcome to On the Bookshelf.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate the opportunity to join you here today.
I suppose that one of the things that's kind of unusual to think is that Richard Nixon was the first president from California. The second president would be Ronald Reagan, but as big a state as California is and as much influence as it's had politically through the years, it's kind of a shock to realize that Richard Nixon was the very first president from there.
It really is, and it's also interesting how he's, you know, that makes him the first really Southwestern, you know, conservative, individualist-minded person to really come onto the national scene.
Yes, indeed. And what I really enjoyed about the book is that you took us back to his birth and his parents and his grandparents on both sides and how they lived. And I think rather than me reiterate what you say in the book, tell us about the very humble beginnings that Richard Nixon had.
Well, it's quite incredible because when you come to Los Angeles now, it's this vast stucco metropolis. But when Richard Nixon was born in Yorba Linda in 1913, it was wide open. It was country. And his father built a home on a 9-acre ranch. That's the home that's still at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library. But even, you know, it was so wide open that even by 1920, when Richard Nixon was 7 years old, the population of Yorba Linda was only 350 people. It was the type of place where people would say that, you know, you went through the town and didn't even know you went through the town. And it was a place where people were self-reliant, and they grew their own vegetables, and they, you know, hunted rabbits and took care of themselves and their community. And his father, in fact, Frank Nixon, helped build the first French church in Yorba Linda. And it was really wide open. And even when he moved to Whittier in 1922, he moved to the East Whittier section of what is now Whittier. But back in those days, even that was out in the country. His parents picked a place to build a house and a service station that was halfway between Whittier proper and La Habra. And that's a 7-mile distance between those two. So it was about 3.5 miles out in the country where people lived on 10 acres, and, you know, homes could be a mile apart, and they would be, that would be your closest neighbor. And so it really was a vastly different upbringing than what is currently in Southern California, and it really was a fascinating time for them to grow up in this idea of self-reliance and community and the strength of their family.
I was fascinated to realize that Richard Nixon was quite an accomplished amateur pianist, that he played the piano at his church. He was a Quaker and very devout Quaker, and his whole family was this way, and he played the piano at church and played piano for most of his life, as a matter of fact, for political gatherings and friends and so forth. We just never got those kind of images from the press when Richard Nixon was in political office at all, and I suppose I don't want to jump too quickly ahead, but it really goes back to the first time he was really noticed on the national scene was in the Alger Hiss hearings, and it seems like the press decided right then that they didn't like him, and they kept that sort of sense of animosity and mistrust going from that point forward. Is that too difficult a proclamation?
No, you really hit the nail right on the head, and it really kind of goes toward, you know, at that time period in 1947, 1948, when the Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers case is going on, Richard Nixon is really, you know, as I mentioned before, that first Southwestern individualist conservative type of person, and your media center is the Northeast. Alger Hiss is you know, ensconced in the Northeast liberalism. He's a part of the Roosevelt administration, and he goes to Yalta with Roosevelt, and he's part of the Truman administration. He's at the founding of the United Nations, and so he's really, you know, looked upon favorably by that media. And then here's this, you know, young upstart Richard Nixon, and how dare he, you know, take on this great, you know, American Alger Hiss and then prove Alger Hiss to be a liar. And it really it conflicted that Northeast media, and it juxtaposed him against them forevermore after that. And it had a lasting effect, because even in his White House days, you know, getting back to the piano, he played at the Grand Ole Opry and things like that that you never really hear about. And he was so accomplished at the piano, he played by ear, and he usually played in the key of G.
He's extremely successful at Whittier College, a private Christian school. Does all sorts of things. He's in the theater group. He's a champion debater. Sings in the chorus. He's a bass. All sorts of nice, normal things. And once again, things we've never heard about Richard Nixon before. And when he meets Pat, this becomes the love of his life. And this is the woman to whom he is faithful for 53 and a half years until her death. That's a sweet story. And once again, we don't get a lot of sweet stories about Richard Nixon.
In fact, what you hear about him is this entire false narrative that has really been manufactured by these psychohistorians that were popular in the 1970s after he resigned, where they tried to create a narrative of his life. And really, the first one to do it was Fawn Brody. But these psychohistorians took the position that, you know, he's a villain, and here's this villain that resigned the presidency, so let's make up the history that supports the fact that he's a villain. And so they make him be an outsider, unpopular, insecure, not one of the cool kids, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, you mentioned Whittier College. Not only was he a champion at debate and in the glee club and singing in the choir and acting in student theater, but he was freshman class president, he was sophomore class representative, he was the student body vice president his junior year, and he was the student body president his senior year. He was voted best man on campus, and, you know, his classmates wrote him a letter in his senior year, and they said, out of every graduating class, there's one person that becomes a remarkable person, and we all believe you're destined to be that person. And then he goes on to Duke with a full scholarship and is president of the Duke Student Bar Association, and just incredible, incredible success. You know, a lot of people say at Whittier College that, well, he, you know, couldn't get in the cool group, which is the Franklins. And the Franklins were, at Whittier College, they didn't have fraternities and sororities, but they had societies, one for the men, the Franklins, and three for the women. And so the narrative has always been, well, he couldn't, you know, get invited to the cool Franklins group, and so he formed his own group, Bitter and Insecure. And the reality is, the year that Nixon went to Whittier College as a freshman, Vern Landreth had been hired from Huntington Park as a coach, and Wallace Newman had been hired from Covina as a coach. And those two men brought with them a bunch of their seniors from their respective high schools where they had taught before coming to Whittier College. And those two groups of athletes bonded on the football field, and Richard Nixon played football for Whittier College all 4 years, and he bonded with them, and they took a look at the Franklins, who like to sponsor afternoon teas and take their annual pictures in tuxedos, and they decided, we want to form our own society that's more in tune with our athleticism and what we're all about. And they formed that group, the Orthogonians, and they had Nixon be the president of it the first year. And the Orthogonians took over the school for the most part. They, you know, for the next six, eight student body elections, they won the presidency. They really came in and dominated. And so it wasn't this, you know, uncool kid forming his own group of uncool kids. It was, you know, this go-getter really forming the most popular group on campus. And then even when he came back from law school, you know, he was president of the Duke Alumni Association. He was president of the Whittier Colleges Alumni Association. He was the youngest person ever voted to be a member of the Whittier College Board of Trustees. He was president of the 2030 Social Club. He would give talks at other social clubs and sing, you know, their club songs and play their club songs on the piano. And, you know, he continued to be active in his church and played, in community theater as well. And he was assistant Whittier City of Attorney. He became the chief trial attorney of his own law firm. And through it all, he's active with his family and in love with Pat and dating Pat. And they met the first night that they were auditioning for the play The Dark Tower. And he told her that first night in January 1938, you know, I'm going to marry you. And they were married in June of 1940.
He never was unfaithful to his wife, cherished her, and relied on her encouragement and support through all the good years and the tough years. It really is a wonderful love story. And once again, one that we don't hear, sadly enough. You've certainly done an incredible job in bringing all sorts of things from the early years of Richard Nixon, but also a much more rounded look at his entire career and life. Let's talk just a minute about his years in World War II. He was in the U.S. Navy during the Second World War and in the South Pacific, right?
Yes, and that is an incredible time period where you take a look at Richard Nixon, and he's a Quaker, and Quakers don't have to serve in the military. They're pacifists by nature. But the Quaker church that he's a member of in East Whittier, it was more evangelical, and almost all the young men in his age group from that part of the church enlisted in the service. Richard Nixon was initially stationed in Ottumwa, Iowa, at a Navy airfield that they were building. And he could have stayed there and been, you know, you can't get farther away from the war in Europe or the war in the Pacific than being in Ottumwa, Iowa. And, you know, he volunteered to be stationed on an aircraft carrier or at a base closer to the action. So they sent him to New Caledonia in the South Pacific. And he became a member of what was called the South Pacific Combat Air Transport Command. It was called SCAT. They also called it Murder, Inc., because really what they did in SCAT was they didn't have enough aircraft carriers to send out throughout the world to fight both in the Pacific and in the European theater. So what they did in the South Pacific, there's island chains that were north of Australia, like the Solomon Islands, the Marshall Islands, Vanuatu, the different island chains. And the Japanese were seeking to conquer all those island chains and cut the United States off from Australia and all of the shippings that would go through the Straits of Malacca. And so the Navy treated those islands as aircraft carriers, and they would send in the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy, take over an island, build a runway as fast as possible, and then start using that to land aircraft and push them into more forward bases. And Richard Nixon asked to be the officer in charge of landings on new islands. And normally that position was always held by a member of the Marine Corps. But he impressed his Marine Corps commanding officer so much that he was selected to go ahead and be that officer in charge on a couple islands. And, you know, they were really running an airline that was moving men and materials into combat and wounded men back out of combat, and they were doing it on all these islands and being bombed by the Japanese at the same time. And so it was really a hectic mess, and it's a fascinating way to study and see how the war was conducted down in the South Pacific, because it was done in a way that was so fundamentally different than the European conflict. And it was fighting island to bloody island. Mm. And once you're on an island, you didn't have anywhere else to go. And right. So it was, you know, stand and fight.
The kind of attitude that Richard Nixon had as a young man, as a college student, as a lawyer, as a veteran of the U.S. Navy in World War II, he brings the same sort of sensitivity and the same sort of training and experience when he decides to do public service, that is to say, run for government offices. Within 6 years, he's elected to the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and the Vice Presidency. That's pretty extraordinary. And you mentioned that he's the only president in the 20th century to have been elected twice as vice president and twice as president.
He and Franklin Roosevelt are the only two American politicians that have been on national ballots five times. More people have voted for Richard Nixon than any other American politician.
For folks who weren't around in those days, it's very easy to put all our attention in his political career on Watergate. But he was an exceptional vice president. Nixon was the right-hand man. He had more to do. He did more international traveling than any vice president in American history up to that point. That might even still be a record that he set. And in the first term of President Nixon, he made a lot of really extraordinary things. Even though he considered himself a conservative, these days we might say he was sort of a moderate, but he was really just a conservationist, wasn't he?
He was. He was, and you're absolutely right. And, you know, really, when you look at his life, especially in the way I've kind of laid it out, you see a man that believes in service over self. He is an incredible administrator. He's an incredible, has an incredible ability to delegate. And if you look at his, time as vice president, he really is working as an administrator and getting things done. And then when he's president, you know, think of all the things he did, you know, the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. He opened China. He did the first nuclear arms treaty. He was the first president to go to Moscow. He signed Title IX, fundamentally changing women's collegiate sports. He quadrupled the amount of women in government. And for the first time ever, you know, women were Secret Service agents, FBI agents, you know, drug agents. They were tugboat captains. And he put them on commissions and in charge of commissions. He tried to appoint the first woman to the United States Supreme Court in Mildred Lilly, a California Court of Appeal justice. And he just did one thing after another. But what's most fascinating about it all is not once did he ever have a Republican majority in either the House or the Senate. He did it all by working with the loyal opposition.
There's one thing that stuck out I'd never heard anywhere else, and I'm going to quote you. Knowing from personal experience not everyone could afford a trip to Yellowstone or Yosemite, Nixon also sought to bring the parks to the people. His instruction in dealing with excess federal land was, when in doubt, make a park of it. In total, 642 new parks were created during Nixon's presidency. That's extraordinary.
Yes.
I remember the creation of the EPA. I remember the National Environmental Policy Act, Clean Air Act, Oil Pollution Act, Noise Control Act, Clean Water Act, Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act, Coastal Zone Management Act. I was a paperboy during those years, and I remember reading those things as I'm throwing the newspapers. And yet nobody mentions that anymore. It's like this one thing that happened to him in his second term completely obliterates an entire life of service, and that is a tragedy. For example, it's important to know that President Nixon got reelected with, was it the highest percentage of any president in the 20th century? Nowadays, we talk a lot about close races. Well, the 1960 race, in which he was defeated for the presidency, was the closest race still in U.S. history, and the widest disparity between a winning candidate and losing candidate happened in 1972, correct?
Yes, and he flipped the whole country. You know, Humphrey ran against him in 1968. He even flipped Minnesota. He won everywhere. He won 520 electoral college votes. It was an astounding victory. And, you know, getting back to some of his lasting legacies and him not getting any credit, you know, you think about, I am a product of the all-volunteer Navy. I served in the Navy in the 1980s. He ended the draft.
Yeah.
He created the all-volunteer military that stands to this day. And in terms of the parks, you know, one of the greatest surf breaks in the world is San Onofre down in Southern California by just south of San Clemente, and it's old man's, you know, and everyone sings about it, and it's wonderful, and he's the one that opened it up as part of that whole initiative to turn the excess land into parks. And you'll hear any discussion of any of these amazing accomplishments that he had, and it really had to do with his ability to do that service over self, which he even showed in, you know, you mentioned the 1960 election. Eisenhower wanted him to do a legal challenge to that election because of the fraud. Eisenhower's cabinet was willing to fund the legal challenge, and Richard Nixon said, no, it's more important for our country to have stability and show the rest of the world that we don't have fraudulent elections, and I'm not going to do this. And he knew it was in his best interest to do it, to challenge it and try and win, but it wasn't in the country's best interest, and he just walked away.
You know,
it's an incredible story, incredible all-American story.
You know, essentially, he did the same thing when he stepped down as president rather than be impeached. He was concerned about the integrity of the office. When you contrast that to people who have held the office over the last, 20 years or so, that sort of attitude is completely alien to them. They hang on no matter what. And another thing that I found fascinating is that when Nixon ran, the Democrats in California widely supported him especially on his earlier races. But really, every time he ran, the Californians voted for him. What a very different situation we have in California today. I think he would be very sad to see how things have changed.
Yeah, no, he was endorsed in every campaign. He was endorsed by the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Times is one of the only national newspapers that never called for his resignation. And in California, all the way back to when he first ran for Congress, the voting registration favors the Democrats by about 1 million votes. And he wins. You know, when he ran for Congress in 1946, the issue was really veterans' rights and veterans' housing and veterans' education. It was right after World War II. It was the housing explosion in Southern California. And he took on Jerry Voorhees, a five-term incumbent Democrat, who was voted as having the third safest seat in the House of Representatives, and he was voted as being the best congressman west of the Mississippi. And Nixon took him on. He did five debates against him, and he just filleted him in those debates, and he beat him, and he even beat Voorhees in Voorhees' own hometown of Diamond Bar. And then back in those days, when it came to reelection, the politicians could cross-file. So Richard Nixon cross-filed and ran as a Democrat and a Republican in the primaries and won them both, which, by the way, gave him the time to then get into the Alger Hiss case because he didn't. It was really August, September of that year, and he didn't have to spend it all campaigning out here in Southern California. And so he's reelected in 1948, and then in 1950, he takes on Helen Gahagan Douglas, and he beats her in the largest landslide of any Senate race that year. And you had people like Edwin Pauley, for whom the UCLA Pauley Pavilion is named. He was the former treasurer of the Democrat National Committee under Roosevelt. He was a staunch Democrat. He was very close with Truman. And he supported Nixon in that race against Helen Gahagan Douglas. And there was just an incredible amount of Democrat supports for him. He had to have Democrat support to win because the numbers are so skewed in California against the Republicans.
There's so much about Richard Nixon that I find absolutely fascinating. The personal losses he suffered as a child, having two brothers die before he was a grown-up. But there was something else that you uncovered for your book, California's Native Son, and that was his civil rights stances were always on the progressive side. He befriended Martin Luther King Jr. and went to his funeral, and even though Bobby Kennedy was a pretty dedicated political opponent, and including some dirty tricks against him even after his big brother died, when Bobby Kennedy died, Nixon went to his funeral too. He just a really warm-hearted and genuine guy a real compassionate person and a very devout Christian who lived out his faith his entire life.
He did. He did, and he lived out his dreams his entire life, because when he was in the eighth grade, he said, I want to graduate from, you know, Whittier College and go to law school so that I could be of some good to the people. And, you know, as a think about an eighth grader writing out something like that and then living it the entire rest of his life. You know, you mentioned the civil rights. You know, he grew up with Hispanics in the orchards down here in Southern California. And in his first year in office, when they went to do, towards the end of 69, they were getting ready for the 1970 census. And he said, well, I want you to make sure that you include Hispanics in the counting, because people have to have representation, and the only way you can get representation is if you count them, and you could see how many there are. And they told him, well, we've already printed the census forms. And he says, I don't care, reprint them and put Hispanics down. And so he started counting them because he knew they needed representation. And he really took from his life, his experiences, and then implemented policies that were better for all of us. And he gets almost no credit for any of that.
Absolutely. It's a very rounded version of him. Sports fan till his last days, who wrote a book called Six Crises before he ever ran for president. If he'd written it later, he could have called it Eight or Nine Crises. But he wrote a bunch of books after Watergate, after suffering terribly physical manifestations of what he'd gone through, he comes back and becomes an elder statesman with the Frost interviews helped that, but also his tenacity and his determination to hold his head up high, and people realize that this was still a righteous guy, and your book does a magnificent job in giving us an alternate view of someone whose history has been very difficult on. So, Ron, I want to thank you for that. Is there anything else that you wanted to say that I neglected to ask?
No, you know, the only thing that I would say is, you know, you had mentioned my website, which is it's richardnixonsocal.com. But the one thing that I would want all of your listeners to know is I'm a trial attorney, and I'm used to people telling me what they want me to believe. You know, my clients do that all the time.
Right.
And then I go look at the evidence to see what it actually shows. And I have, you know, I consumed 125,000 pages of documentary evidence in creating this biography, and I have cited to everything in it. And so it's really not, it's not my version of Richard Nixon, it's what the evidence shows, and I've cited to all of it. And so it's all available for anyone to double check, and I invite anyone to, anything that they want to look up, it's right there, and I've laid it all out for them to take a look at. And it's truly a remarkable all-American story that people should take a look at.
Well, I think President Nixon, the lawyer, would particularly appreciate the fact that you're the one that did all this research and vetted everything.
Well, thank you, sir.
Paul, it's been a great pleasure to get a chance to talk to you. Your book is going to be one that I keep because it's just extraordinary, and I'm certainly going to encourage other people to go buy a copy, available online and in bookstores everywhere. And
thank you so much.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you,
and for joining us and sharing it with our listeners here on The Bookshelf.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I hope everyone has a great President's Day.
Once again, our special guest today, Paul Carter, the author of Richard Nixon, California's Native Son, from Potomac Books. Thanks so much for joining us on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Take a look at it, take a listen to it, and tell your friends, won't you? Until the next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.